What are the appropriate things that we ought to be doing together as the people of God? What is the work that God has assigned us to do as a local congregation of His people? What activities should we be engaged in? What services should we be providing? Those kinds of questions. How would you go about answering that? Well, to some people, what church needs to be about is just whatever they want the church to be about. And so people just kind of say, well, here's what I think it ought to be. And there's an assumption there, or maybe I would better use the word presumption there, that God will be pleased with whatever it is we come up with that we think is a good thing. More thoughtful people will say, let's go to the Bible. Let's go to the Scriptures and see what they say about what our activities ought to be. But even as we do that, people don't always agree on how we ought to approach the Scriptures on that question, and therefore we come to different conclusions about that. There are some who approach that question by turning to the book of Acts and looking at the examples that we have there, and then turning to the letters that Paul wrote to the churches or to the preachers and seeing what the instructions are there. And based on those instructions and based on those examples, we say, this is what God wants us to be doing. But there are others who take a different approach to that, and an increasingly popular approach is just to say, well, what did Jesus do? Or what do we think Jesus would do? And then, based on whatever Jesus did, we say, well, that's what we ought to be doing, and that's what we can be doing. I want to ask you the question this morning. Is that a good approach to answering this question? May the church do whatever Jesus did. Is that the right approach to it? Just to look at what Jesus did, and then whatever Jesus did, that's what we need to be doing. That's our collective function. That's what we need to be providing, including the facilities in which to provide it. Is that the way to go about answering that question? I attended a public discussion on this question several years ago, and that is exactly the way that one brother argued it, that this is whatever the church did, or whatever Jesus did, rather, that's what the church should be doing. Is that the right approach to this? Let's ask that question this morning. And maybe as I ask that question, you're thinking to yourself, well, preacher, why are you bothering me with that question? Why, the answer to that is obvious. You don't have to take my time with that. Obviously, the church can do whatever Jesus did. After all, Jesus is the head of the church. Paul said so in Colossians chapter 1 and verse 18. And surely if the head is leading, the body should do whatever the head did. And besides that, Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 2 that Jesus is our example and we should follow in His steps. So whatever Jesus did, that's what we need to be doing. It's obvious. On the other hand, somebody over the other side of the coin is looking at that and saying, obviously, of course that can't be. Why, Jesus lived under the law of Moses. And the law of Moses has been taken away, so we can't do everything that Jesus did, otherwise we'd be observing the law of Moses. And Jesus lived in the age of miraculous gifts, and we're not living in that age anymore. And a lot of what Jesus did was miraculous, and so we can't possibly do all the things that Jesus did. Obviously, the answer to this question is no. Or is it so obvious? To deal with those second objections, somebody will say, well, okay, we're going to have to leave off the things that pertain just to the law of Moses. We can do everything else that Jesus did, but not those things. But in application, that's not always where folks go. There was a church in Houston, Texas, several years ago that made the news as they gathered in their fellowship hall to observe the Passover. A very Jewish thing that Jesus did. And maybe they reasoned that since Paul said that Christ is our Passover, he said that in 1 Corinthians 5, that it would be all right to do something like that. And as far as those miraculous things, well, in that debate that I attended, the brother took one of the miraculous examples of Jesus' activity and used that to justify the church being involved in that same activity. And his reasoning was that whatever Jesus did supernaturally, we can still do to the extent we can naturally and do whatever Jesus did. So maybe it's not as cut and dry as we might think right up front. How would this work in practicality if we're going to do whatever we find Jesus doing, including providing not only those services, but the facilities in which to do them and the resources for them and all that? How does that play out in reality? Let's turn our Bibles to the Gospel of John. And for our lesson this morning, I'm just going to take a quick survey through the Gospel of John and just ask ourselves, what would this look like by way of application? Let's look at some things we find Jesus doing in the Gospel of John and ask ourselves, what's that going to look like if we try to apply this principle of the church doing whatever Jesus did? In John chapter 1, Jesus is introduced to his disciples. In John chapter 2, I find the Lord attending a wedding, and at this particular wedding, the wine ran out. Jesus said to the servants in verse 7 of John 2, "Fill the water pots with water." So they filled them to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw out some now and take it to the head waiter." So they took it to him. When the head waiter tasted the water, which had become wine, and did not know where it came from, verse 10, he called the groom together and complimented this good wine. And John says in verse 11, this was the beginning of his signs that Jesus did in Cana of Galilee. So the first thing I see Jesus doing in this text is he's making wine. He's turning water into wine. How do we apply that? How's the church going to do what Jesus did on this occasion? Will this justify a church vineyard and a church winery? We would be doing what Jesus did on this occasion, wouldn't we? And then in verse 13, John says, "The Passover of the Jews was near, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. He found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves and the money changers seated at the tables. He made a scourge of cords and drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And to those who were selling the doves, he said, 'Take these things away. Stop making my Father's house a place of business.'" Jesus on this occasion is cleansing the temple. He is making a physical assault on those who in the name of God are practicing things that are false. And in verse 17, his disciples remembered that it was written of him, "Zeal for your house will consume me." And this isn't an isolated incident either. In the other gospel accounts, they indicate that Jesus did this same thing again right toward the end of his public ministry. How do we do that? Do we make some sort of a physical assault on those that are practicing false religion in the name of the Lord? I guess march into their assembly and overturn the drums and drive out the choir, or however we would do that exactly. In John chapter 3, Jesus is teaching. In John chapter 4, Jesus is teaching. Then I come down toward the end of John chapter 4, and I see Jesus healing people. John 4:46, he came to Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water wine. There was a royal official whose son was sick at Capernaum. When he heard that Jesus had come out of Judea into Galilee, he went to him and was imploring him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Jesus said to him in verse 50, "Go, your son lives." The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and started off. And now as he was going down, his slaves met him saying that his son was living. So he inquired of them at the hour when he began to get better. Then they said to him, "Yesterday, at the seventh hour, the fever left him." So the father knew that it was at that hour in which Jesus said to him, "Your son lives." And he himself believed in his whole household. John says this is the second sign that Jesus performed when he'd come out of Judea into Galilee. And then in chapter 5, just continues with a multitude of people who were lame. Jesus singled out one lame man and told him in verse 11, pick up your pallet and walk. He told him that in verse 8, rather. And immediately the man became well and picked up his pallet and began to walk. Jesus was healing people. Now, we can't do that miraculously. We don't have that gift today. But if we can operate in the natural realm, doing the same things that Jesus was doing in the supernatural realm, would this not then justify a church hospital, a church clinic of various kinds, in order to make everybody well as much as possible? Then in John chapter 6, there's a great crowd of folks gathered together. And once again, healing is a part of it. Verse 2 says, a large crowd followed him because they saw the signs which he was performing on those who were sick. This was a large crowd that was gathered, and it was time for something to eat. And so the Lord said to Philip in verse 5, he said, where are we going to buy bread so that these may all eat? Philip answered in verse 7, he said, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, for everyone to receive a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, there is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are these for so many people? Jesus said, have the people sit down. Now there was much grass in the place. So the men sat down in number about 5,000. Then Jesus took the loaves, that's those loaves the little boy had in verse 9, and having given thanks, he distributed to those who were seated, likewise also of the fish, as much as they wanted. Jesus is reproducing food on this occasion. He's feeding a crowd of 5,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish. This is the incident the brother in the debate was referring to when he was saying the church can do whatever Jesus was doing, and he was using this to defend the idea of the church providing dinners and a dining hall and all that sort of thing. It occurred to me as he was saying that this was probably not the best example to use for that, because in this case, Jesus is not simply in the food distribution business, he's in the food production business. He's making the food on this occasion from scratch, as it were, literally. Would this then authorize us having a church bakery? A church fishery? To provide all this food that we're going to distribute? That's what the Lord is doing. He's providing the food that the disciples would distribute. In John chapter 6, Jesus is teaching, again in chapter 7, again in chapter 8. In chapter 9, Jesus is in Jerusalem, and he passed by and saw a man who was blind from birth. His disciples asked, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind? Jesus' answer was neither. Verse 6, when he said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and applied the clay to his eyes and said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. So he went away and washed and came back seeing. Now this touched off a great controversy because the Lord had done this on the Sabbath day, but it was a remarkable circumstance of Jesus healing again. In this case, the blind man. Now, our question is, can the church do whatever Jesus did? Again, we can't do this miraculously, but maybe we could open up an eye clinic that would help to heal those folks that are blind. In John, the 10th chapter, I see Jesus teaching again. And in John 11, as he's teaching, he gets word that his good friend Lazarus has fallen sick. Lazarus lived at Bethany. And the Lord did not immediately go to Lazarus' side. He purposefully delayed until Lazarus had died. Then Jesus and the disciples went to Lazarus. Verse 38 of John 11. Jesus, again, deeply moved within, came to the tomb. Now it was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, "Remove the stone." Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said, "Did I not say to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" And they prayed. Then verse 43 says, when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth!" The man who had died came forth, bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face was wrapped around with a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." Jesus raised the dead. And I'll just confess to you, I have no idea how we would make any application of this one. So we'll go on. In chapter 12, Jesus makes his way to Jerusalem. He announces his death. In chapter 13, beginning and going John 13 through 17, Jesus met with the disciples in the upper room. In that meeting, and this is the night before Jesus' crucifixion, John says in verse 4 of John 13 that Jesus got up from supper and laid aside his garments, and taking a towel, he girded himself. Then he poured water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Jesus washed the disciples' feet. What application might we make of that? Does that say we ought to have a church bathhouse of some sort? Or should we just practice foot washing? I don't know of any churches today that are doing that, but historically there have been some who practiced a ritual of foot washing based on Jesus having done this and having said in the chapter, verse 15, "I gave you an example that you also should do as I did to you." Well, and then in John 18, Jesus is arrested, taken before Pilate. He's crucified in chapter 19, buried at the end of the chapter. Chapter 20, he rises from the dead. And then in the last chapter of John, in John chapter 21, Peter and several of the disciples went fishing. They fished all night and caught nothing. Verse 4 says, "When the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. So Jesus said to them, 'Children, you do not have any fish, do you?' They answered him, 'No.' And he said to them, 'Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find a catch.' So they cast. And then they were not able to haul it in because of the great number of fish. Therefore that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, 'It is the Lord.' So when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put his outer garment on, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. But the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards away, dragging the net full of fish. So when they got out on the land, they saw a charcoal fire already laid and fish placed on it and bread. Jesus said to them, 'Bring some of the fish which you have now caught.' Simon Peter went up and drew the net to the land full of large fish, 153. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, 'Come and have breakfast.'" The Lord had cooked breakfast for the disciples. He had it all ready for them. To my mind, this was the example the brother should have used. This was what he was wanting to do. He was wanting to have us in a circumstance where we're cooking breakfast or dinner or whatever it is and providing for folks. That's exactly what Jesus was doing. Does that mean then that we should have the church kitchen and the church dining hall and have the church meals and all that kind of thing? That's what Jesus was doing. He was cooking for the disciples. All right, here's a summary. Here's all the things we've seen that Jesus was doing in John chapter 11. And if we're going to operate on the premise that whatever Jesus did, that's what the church ought to be doing, then we should have all of these things. Because Jesus was doing all of these things. One of them is absolutely as valid as another. The same logic that brings us to one would bring us to the other. The same reasoning that brings us to one would bring us to the other. And I know that there's nobody that thinks we ought to be doing all these things. I get that. But there are some folks who think we should be doing some of these things based on this premise. And I'm saying if the premise is valid, one application is just as legitimate as the other. If not, why not? What's the problem here? What's wrong with this approach that whatever Jesus did, that's what the church ought to be doing as well? Let me suggest two or three things that are problematic about this approach. First of all, this is simply not the approach that the first century church took. As the church was under the leadership of the apostles who were inspired by the Holy Spirit, this is not at all what they did. They didn't operate under the premise that whatever Jesus did, the church collectively needs to be doing as well and providing all of these kinds of services and activities. That's simply not how they operate. Under their direction, you can read about this in the book of Acts or read the letters. Under the Spirit's direction, churches were busy preaching and teaching, primarily. You can also find them engaged in the activity of providing for the needy among them, whether the needy of this congregation or the needy perhaps in churches in other places. I can read about them selecting their leaders and the special servants who will work among them. I can read about them worshiping together. I can read about them determining whom they will and will not include in their association. But I don't read about bakeries and dinners and hospitals and whatever else was on that list. You just don't read about that. As the church being involved in all those sorts of things. That's not how they went about it. And one of the problems with this approach is it ignores the fact that sometimes the Lord gives us instructions that pertain to our work individually as Christians, and then sometimes He gives us instructions that pertain to the things that we do together, and they're not always the same. It's a difference between individual and collective action. For example, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, that we read a lot on Sundays, the Corinthians were bringing what I would call an ordinary meal into their assembly and combining it with the Lord's Supper. And Paul told them, don't do that. Now, there was nothing wrong with those folks eating. It's just the context in which they were doing it was wrong. That wasn't a part of their collective function as they gathered together for worship. He said, if anybody's hungry, let them eat at home. In chapter 14, when he lays down the rules about our assemblies, there is a clear difference in how the first century Christians exercised their miraculous ability in the assembly versus outside of that. One set of rules for what they might do individually, another set when they came together. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, as Paul talks about the subject of caring for the needy brethren, particularly widows in that place, there is a clear difference made between the rules, as it were, the parameters by which a church participates in that versus an individual participating in that. The apostle makes a difference between those two things. And what we do with this approach is we fail to make that distinction at all and just assume that anything that Jesus did becomes necessarily a proper collective function for His people. Now, a Christian might well be a doctor. He might well be a fisherman. He might well be a farmer. He might well be doing some of those things we're talking about. But that doesn't mean it's a part of our assignment together, our collective function. Because the fact of the matter is, using this approach, we can just about decide to do anything we want to. Pretty much anything we want to do, we could figure out some justification by some connection with something Jesus did or said to enable us to do that. For example, suppose we wanted to provide recreational activities. A lot of churches want to do that. Suppose we wanted to do that. Well, all we'd have to do is turn in our Bibles and read the place where Jesus said to the disciples, come, let's get away for a while. See, we all need a break. That's it. Or suppose we wanted to start a travel club. Well, Jesus traveled about, so we could use that justification for that. And on it goes. Pretty much anything we wanted to do, we could find some connection to something Jesus said or did that would make us feel good about it. But that's simply not how the New Testament Christians went about it. That's not the right approach. The right approach is simply to go to our Bibles and say, what are the instructions here for us to do collectively? And that'll be another lesson to look at all of those kinds of things. But again, the emphasis is on spiritual things. And you know, even with Jesus, when He was doing a lot of these things that provided physical benefit for people, feeding the 5,000, for example, these things were intended to be signs to help prove to people who He was so that He could give them the spiritual benefit, which was what He genuinely came to give. In fact, in that case in John chapter 6, the next day, the whole crowd followed Him over to the other side of the sea because they wanted another free lunch. And the Lord rebuked them for that and said they needed to search for the food, seek the food that leads to eternal life rather than that which simply satisfies hunger. It's about spiritual things. That needs to be our focus. Well, I hope this study has been helpful to you. Make you think about this question just a little bit more. We're going to get ready now and sing our song of invitation. The great physician. That's what Jesus was. He's the great healer. Not just a healer of people's bodies, but a healer of souls. And He would use His power to heal the body to demonstrate His power to heal the soul. And it's the same compassion that He had that led Him to help the blind man or to help the poor man that led Him to go to the cross. For all of us, so that we could be healed. Will you come to Jesus in order to receive that healing? Confess your faith in Him and be baptized into Him for the forgiveness of your sins? If you're ready to do that, come on down to the front now. Let's stand and sing.